Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 13th of November. We are going to be talking about the ocean this hour of our program, which we did a little bit yesterday, but today we have found our guest and we're happy to speak with her to answer the many questions that came up actually during the conversation that we all had yesterday morning. Our guest is the co-author of a wonderful book, National Geographic Ocean, an Illustrated Atlas. For those of you who were anticipating an interview on the transition period of Abraham Lincoln, that interview will be rescheduled. That also is a terrific book and so pertinent right now. So we will be speaking with the author of that book, who is the co-director of the Lincoln Bicentennial Commission, probably sometime next week. Joining us this hour is Sylvia Earle, and Sylvia has quite a background. She has been called a hero for the planet by Time Magazine. She's been called a living legend by the Library of Congress. She's had more than 60 expeditions as an oceanographer and explorer, has authored 170 publications, lectured in many countries around the globe, formerly chief scientist of NOAA, NOAA, and she is an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, chair of the Deep Ocean Exploration and Research, and leader of the Sustainable Seas Expeditions. So she is with us this hour to talk about this terrific book that looks at, well, there are great maps of what the bottom of the ocean looks like. There are reports on what's happened to fish in the ocean and to coral reefs in the ocean, the effect of global warming on the ocean and all of the creatures in that part of the world. So we're going to talk about it. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org, for you to join our conversation. Sylvia, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, nice to be on board.
Yeah. Well, you have had, what a life you've had.
Oh, it's a good start.
It is. It's a good start. What's next, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, my. You've seen so much that many of us have just never seen.
Well, there's so much more to see. 95% of the ocean has not been seen by anybody. People think, some do, that that exploration is basically over for this planet, at least, that the only frontiers are out there in the sky somewhere. But in fact, this part of the solar system, this part of the universe is still largely unexplored. We know of places on the land, of course, that are still lightly known, but the ocean, we've learned more in the last 50 years than during all preceding history, but it's, and new things are being discovered all the time. But maybe the greatest discovery of all in the 20th century was the recognition that the ocean, unlike the feeling that some people still have, the ocean is not infinite in its capacity to take whatever we put into it or to continue perking along as always, no matter what we take out of it. I think the other big discovery is that we're absolutely, totally reliant on the ocean for much that we take for granted, including life itself. But our health, our security, our prosperity, it all links back to the ocean.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the exploration. It seems to me as though we could perhaps be healthier and have a number of wonderful positive effects as a result of exploring more of the ocean, because we don't know that much about it yet. Imagine what it might do for the planet and for all of us. Why is it that it's just 5%? Is it very hard to explore the ocean?
Well, we know quite a lot about the surface. Ships have been plying the surface of the sea and the sampling the depths below with various instruments and devices, but submarines. I've had a chance of using about 30 variations on the theme of little submarines, plus remotely operated vehicles. But for the most part, those have been deployed largely in the latter part of the 20th century, and now sneaking into the 21st. The ocean is vast, and I think there has been the impression that the ocean will take care of itself, no matter what happens to it.
Right.
And I think it's only in recent years that we've begun to appreciate the profound ways that the ocean shapes the way the world works. Most of the oxygen is generated in the sea by the many little green guys that make up the plankton, much of the plankton around the blue part of the planet. Much of the carbon dioxide is absorbed by the ocean. It drives the way the world works, shapes the chemistry. Every drop of water we drink, every breath we take, it doesn't matter where on the planet you live, you're totally reliant on the existence of the ocean. Take away the ocean, you've got a planet a lot like Mars. And it's not very hospitable for the likes of us.
Right. Let's talk about the plastic in the ocean. Somehow this has stayed in my mind. I can't remember who said this. It was on an interview some time ago. That we've now put so much plastic into the ocean that it's almost the size of the continent of Africa.
Well, it's diffuse throughout the waters of the world. I was in the high Arctic this past July. And it was just amazing how much little shredded debris, and some big chunks as well, were making their way up to the far north. It's true all over the world. I've been in remote parts of the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. One of the biggest problems turns out to be fishing nets that are either lost or deliberately discarded into the sea. And we're talking many tons, many miles of nets and lines that just are clogging the ocean. When plastic degrades, it doesn't just go away. It just gets into smaller and smaller pieces. And in many parts of the world where the plastic is collecting, the little pieces, there's a term for it, being called nurdles, little tiny chips of plastic, so small that they're barely visible in many cases, compete with the plankton for space. And little fish and even some of the small planktonic creatures engulf these little shreds of plastic. And just as happens with big animals like whales, seals, and birds, their digestive systems get clogged up with these little bits of plastic. So it's a big problem, and it's a problem of the latter part of the 20th century. And if there is something we can do about it, at least to not let any more go into the sea. And some organizations, one in particular, the Ocean Conservancy, has been mobilizing the forces for years of getting people out, at least on the beaches, and divers as well, to go down and extract what they can. There's been a major effort in the northwestern Pacific Islands with volunteers to drag out those discarded nets. It's unimaginable how much stuff we've allowed to get into the ocean.
Right.
It isn't just a bad problem for fish and whales and birds and things. It's a problem for us because we're talking about the planet's circulatory system. It's our life support system. We're really diminishing our chances of having a prosperous future by diminishing the health of the ocean.
Right.
Our health depends on taking care of the ocean.
When you say that there are some things we can do about it, what needs to happen on a worldwide basis? Do people need to sign on to a treaty? Do we need some body that's going to enforce what we don't put in the ocean to make sure we don't do that? How do we regulate this?
Well, in this new volume that the National Geographic has produced, the Atlas for the Ocean, the Illustrated Atlas of the Ocean, we engaged a couple of dozen of the best minds we could find to talk about some of these issues, some of it just in terms of knowledge of the ocean, some of it in terms of solutions about exactly what can we do at this point in time. This issue of plastics is addressed, acidification of the ocean, what we're putting into the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, more than the ocean can absorb, more than the land can absorb, is turning to acid in the sea. And that's bad news for coral reefs and for those little organisms that generate the oxygen and absorb carbon dioxide. Those with a calcium carbonate shell are affected, along with a great many other organisms that are critical in terms of shaping the food webs in the sea and the chemistry of the ocean, the chemistry of the planet. In this atlas, chapter by chapter, we look at the oceans, and I think one of the things people can do is become better informed. This is one place to start, but there are many places that you can go for information about the ocean and get up to speed. Know what you're eating. That's one of the
right,
big problems.
Know what you're eating.
There are many creatures that are in real trouble because we have taken too many unsustainably. that there is this wonderful dream of being able to extract wildlife from the sea at a level that we can just keep taking and they'll grow back. We take some more, they'll grow back. But there's not much evidence that we have found the magic number of how many we can take, get away with it. In fact, it's quite the contrary. We've lost 90% of many of the fish.
90%? Isn't that astronomical?
Now, think tunas, swordfish, orange roughy that we didn't even begin to extract from the ocean until about 30 years ago because they live about 2,000 feet down in deep water. We couldn't get there until recent years. But now that we can get into deeper places in the sea, we're essentially mining creatures such as the so-called Chilean sea bass, the Arctic cod, and certainly the orange roughy, long-lived, slow-to-reproduce creatures. It takes 30 years for orange roughy to just mature. That little fillet on your plate that at my local supermarket sells for about $9 a pound, which just seems awfully pricey for a little piece of fish, but it's not nearly enough to compensate for a fish that may be 100 or 150 or 200 years old. A little tiny sliver, a fish that may give you 20 minutes of dining pleasure, but it has taken maybe 200 years to grow.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it's ridiculous that we should think of that as a sustainable source of protein. I mean, we take chickens, we grow them. It takes about a year and about 2 pounds of plants to make a pound of chicken or catfish or tilapia. They're fast-growing, they're low on the food chain, and it's a really good source of protein. But to take deep-sea fish or wild fish from the sea, we need to be very careful about how many we take and also how they're taken. This is another issue that's addressed in the National Geographic's Ocean Atlas. There's a map in there that was first published in Science magazine that shows human impacts on the ocean, and particularly the fishing impacts. There are very few places in the sea where pristine populations of fish still exist. Under the ice in the Arctic, but we're edging into that realm as well, around some parts of the South Pacific, a few places that are distant from centers where fishing fleets operate. But they're going fast. They're slipping into oblivion. The things we can do include knowing what you're eating, knowing where it came from, trying to figure out, well, is this really healthy for me? People say, doctors will tell you, well, eating fish is good for you because of the omega-3s and because of the good protein. But what we're putting into the ocean gets into the food chain and comes back to us in terms of mercury and fire retardants and pesticides and all that stuff you really don't want in you.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes back in a concentrated form if you eat high on the food chain, and especially fish that are really old fish, like tunas, maybe 10 years old. If we don't eat 10-year-old cows, we don't eat 10-year-old chickens, but we do eat wildlife from the sea that has been around for many years. And during all that time, even salmon, it takes 3 years before they get out to sea, and once they're out at sea, another 3 years or so before they come back to be caught. And they're often loaded with the kinds of things you really don't want in you. There are other sources of those wonderful omega-3s, including a number of companies that have started to actually grow the plankton that generate the omega-3 oils. The fish don't manufacture them. Plankton do. So it makes sense to go right to the source and, under controlled circumstances, grow the organisms that produce the omega-3s and then just take them directly, like the fish do, for heaven's sake.
And eat them how?
In little pills you can get. Go online and go to, most pharmacies carry fish-free omega-3s. You don't have to kill the fish to get your omega-3s. Many forms of nuts, including walnuts, have good quantities of omega-3s, but the ones that are generated from plankton that are grown are probably the best because that's what fish naturally consume and what you can consume too, bypassing the killing of the fish and the acquisition of all these things you don't want in you.
Right.
Anyway, a number of issues like that. But people, the information is out there.
Right.
And when people ask me, what can I do? Well, become informed so that you can make better choices about how you live. And certainly be very careful about what you allow to flow into the ocean. The ocean's had enough and then some.
What you've said, I think, is news to many of us, too. We think about this when we think about the meat that we eat, but we don't think about it in terms of the fish. We just don't.
No, and the regulations overseeing the good condition of wildlife, we don't even know where most of the fish come from. There's an effort on the part of some responsible restaurants and some responsible grocery stores to tell you that this fish came from Brazil or Chile or from some African country. Or it's hard to find locally acquired fish these days, because going to the fish market or going to a restaurant, it's like going to the United Nations when it comes to consuming seafood. It comes from all over the world. Thailand, from Brazil, that's where some of the lobsters are now coming from, and the Caribbean. It's horrifying to me to find lobsters in this country that have been collected in the Galapagos Islands, a place that is really vulnerable to the extraction of ocean wildlife. It's theoretically protected. It's a World Heritage Area. Galapagos Islands are famous because of their scientific importance. Really a place where many go, using those islands, land, and sea as a living laboratory. But fishing is allowed. So tuna, swordfish, the locally, in fact, even endemic species are taken, endemic meaning that they occur in the Galapagos and only in the Galapagos. Little creatures called sea cucumbers are extracted from waters around there and distributed, especially to Asia, but they come through the United States to get to Asia, Asian markets. People need to know what's happening to ocean wildlife. 300,000 marine mammals every year are killed in the process of taking commercial fish, either deliberately, not deliberately, usually inadvertently, in the course of dragging nets and deploying long lines. But some are also caught, also inadvertently, in the discarded fishing gear. It is so sad to see, as I have on many occasions, these ghost nets, the nets that have been lost or discarded at sea, just continuing to catch turtles, fish that will never go to market. Hmm. They just die, along with sea lions, and even whales get trapped. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
We have to do better than this. It's not that we should stop eating fish, although I personally have. I value these creatures so much alive that I think, well, I can do my bit, just eat something else. But if you really want to eat fish, just be really careful and know where they came from. Ask questions. If you catch them yourself, that seems to me to be okay. And if you're feeding your family or your communities, that has some hope of being sustainable. But these large-scale nets that drag the ocean floor like giant bulldozers, destroying the habitat itself while taking far more fish than the ocean could possibly replenish, that's got to change.
Sylvia Earle is our guest. She is the co-author of the National Geographic Ocean and Illustrated Atlas. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and we'll be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now and start with Jim from Reedsburg. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning to both of you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to ask your guest how much she is in agreement with Al Gore's predictions for the ocean, as for instance, the rising of the oceans. I understand that I've heard the statistic that for every foot that our sea level rises, we lose 50 feet of flat beach. So we're talking about the inundation of coastal wetlands and coastal cities, and, you know, all this water will eventually become brine rather than fresh water. And I'm really curious to see how much she is in agreement with Al Gore.
I very much in agreement with what Al Gore has presented to the public. It's not Al Gore speaking based on all by himself. He is speaking on behalf of the scientific community who have advised him of what's actually happening. I mean, all of us need to, again, be informed and not be so alarmed by the consequences that we fail to really take it seriously. It's like a hurricane coming. If you're prepared, you can take measures to minimize the impact. And also, although we can't at this point in history control what a hurricane does, we can take actions that can begin to minimize the amount of carbon dioxide that goes into the atmosphere and perhaps come up with some creative ways to sequester what is already there. And certainly we should stop doing some of the stupid things that are now causing the release of carbon dioxide in excessive amounts, like burning the forests that sequester the carbon and keep it in place and provide the underpinnings of a healthy planet. And in the ocean, similarly, we're doing things there. Trawling the ocean floor is exceedingly destructive and is undermining the capacity of the natural systems to do what they've done for, lo, these many millions of years, which is to keep, well, there are changes, of course. There are ups and downs. Sea level has gone up and has gone down over the ages. But to minimize the big swings, we're seeing unprecedented in anything in human experience, but going back millions of years before there were humans, the kinds of changes that are well beyond the normal ups and downs of change that the planet goes through and maintains the integrity of the natural systems, such as coral reefs and forests and so on. The wonderful news is that we know, we can see it coming, and that we can take actions before it's too late. But if we're complacent, if we look away and say, I don't think so, or our kids can worry about that, I'm not going to worry, or maybe it's not really happening. It is happening. That's the awareness. Knowing we've got a problem is the first giant step towards solving the problem.
And thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Paul next from Clintonville. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
Hello.
And good morning to your guest.
Good morning.
Hi. Former Navy guy and used to be a long time ago, diver and submarine type. I remember something about your dive in a gym suit to some depth of 1,200 feet or so.
Right.
And I was wondering if you wouldn't mind a few personal reflections on that dive. I mean, I've much admired that from my perspective. What a gutsy lady you are, and I wouldn't mind if you just give us a few words about that.
Yeah, sure, that'd be great.
But first, why are you not diving now? I mean, my mother waited until she was 81 to start.
Oh, my.
It's never too late. As long as you breathe, you can dive.
Okay. Well, I am still sports diving. I'm 62, retired from the Navy. But I still get out there and, you know, play around at the shallow depths whenever I can. I mean, my hard hat experience is limited to old Mark V and that.
Oh my goodness, you're a real diver.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but anyway, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, well, you know, and I want everyone to know what it's like to step into the blue part of the planet. Just diving, just swimming, just snorkeling, swimming with a face mask so you can actually see what's out there is one of the great joys of my life, and I wish everyone would take the plunge. My mother scolded me for not getting her to do it long before, and so I tell people, if you're 81, like my mom, don't wait any longer. If you're older than 81, it's not too late. And if you're younger, well, hurry up, get out there. Imagine in the gym, for example, going down not just where divers go to 50 feet or 100 feet or sometimes tiptoeing down to 150 feet, 50 meters or so. But to keep going down to 100 meters to 200 meters, I actually had to get down, had to stop because that's where the bottom was at 400 meters, 1,250 feet down. And even at midday, in clear ocean water, it was almost dark at that depth. Most of the world, most of the living world, is below that depth, below 400 or 500 meters, below where light penetrates. I sometimes say that most of life on Earth lives in the dark, and not just in Washington, D.C. Anyway, it's glorious. I say it's dark, but actually bioluminescent creatures are everywhere. About 90% of life in the sea, in the deep sea, has some form of bioluminescence. That's the ability to make their own firefly kind of light. So as you descend into the almost light, almost dark twilight zone, and everything beyond that, it's like diving into a starry night.
Oh my.
It's like diving into the 4th of July, these little explosions of light from jellies and little fish that have lights down their side. Swimming creatures such as sea cucumbers that are mainly on the bottom in shallow water, but out in the open ocean. You know, most of the ocean is that juicy part, not the top, not the bottom, but everything in between. Average depth, 2 miles. The maximum, 7 miles. There's so much ocean out there left to explore. And when I got down to the bottom at 400 meters, I could look up and actually see up from down. I could see the faint glow of sunlight above. I could see broad shapes around where I was. And there were lights on the little submarine that took me down to the bottom, and I stepped off the platform that was on the front of the submarine and walked by myself on the ocean floor and had a light to be able to see. But we turned the lights off so that I could get that impression of what it's like to be a creature in the deep sea. And I touched one of the corals. There are many corals that other than those that are in the shallow reef coral area. There are deep corals that live many thousands of feet beneath the surface, and some that I encountered were called bamboo coral or wire corals. They look like big bed springs, about 2 meters high, taller than most people get to be, 6 feet or so. And I reached out with my mechanical-like arm. The suit that I was wearing looks like the Michelin Man. Felt like a walking refrigerator in a way with arms. My arm actually was down the metal sleeve, so I could reach out and touch this wire coral, this bamboo coral, and it burst into blue fire. Little rings of blue light pulsed all the way up and down the length of these beautiful spiral creatures. It was so glorious to see creatures that I had seen before, some of them mangled in a net. When you sample the ocean, you just don't know what it's like down there. But I could actually walk around quietly in the midst of these creatures and see them undisturbed in their own realm. It's something that if people could see what's there, they would want with all their heart, I believe, to take care of it. It's like walking into an art museum. You don't want to tear the things off the walls. You want to just enjoy them for their own sake.
Right.
But for more than that, though, they are components of what make the world work for us. These are the nuts, the bolts, the cogs, the wheels, as Otto Leopold, the writer of the middle of the 20th century, said about creatures on the land. They're what hold the planet together.
Yeah.
And we need to take care of them because they take care of us.
I guess you asked the right question, Paul.
Yeah.
That was great.
Why, that was poetic. I'm sorry I wasn't recording it. My goodness, that was beautiful.
Yes, it
was. Thank you very much for your time. That was great.
I'll see you underwater, I hope.
Oh, I hope so. I'll treasure the conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much for the call. Keith is next from Appleton. Hi, Keith.
Hi there, and good morning.
Hello.
Terrific show. So you just alluded to this just moments ago, but I was interested in what is the importance of coral. What do they do exactly, and how do they fit into the ecosystem at large? And secondly, do you happen to have any humorous anecdotes you'd care to share concerning either of the Cousteaus?
And
either of the
Cousteaus?
Sure, yeah. Well, first things first about the coral reefs. Many liken coral reefs to rainforest. The diversity is at least as great if you're talking about the main divisions of life, the big wedges of diversity. The coral reefs far outweigh anything on the land in terms of diversity, because in an acre of coral reef you might find 20 of the major categories of animal life. There are about 30, 35 major categories of animal life. You might even find as many as 30 in a coral reef, most of them inconspicuous, but all of them important in terms of the genetic makeup of the planet. They represent the history of life on Earth. Many of the creatures were around long before dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are relative newcomers. They're vertebrates. Think about that long stretch of time when only microbes existed on the planet. We're talking billions of years. Multicellular life, including the kinds of things you find on coral reefs, the corals, the sea cucumbers, the little crabs, creatures called peanut worms, the cycunculids, in the waters surrounding the coral reefs, arrow worms, the plankton in a bucket of seawater, you might find as many as a dozen phyla, these great categories of life. There are only about 15 groups of animals of this stature, these phyla, these categories of animal life on the planet, on the terrestrial part of the planet, overall. Nearly all of them are in the ocean, and nearly all of them you can find on a coral reef. So protecting diversity of life, those recipes for how things, for the chemistry of life, how things get to be what they are. If we want to find the mysteries of the universe in terms of life and what, how did we come to be, and how is the chemistry of life actually possible, the answers to some of these great questions are out there in the sea,
mm-hmm.
And coral reefs hold many of them. It's not just coral reefs. They're beautiful and therefore largely accessible, those that are within the illuminated part of the ocean where divers can get to more conveniently. We're finding, though, that there are deep coral reefs, as I mentioned earlier, thousands of feet below the surface, exceedingly vulnerable to the deep-sea trawling that is now taking place to extract wildlife from deep water, now that we've largely overexploited the wildlife in shallow waters. We're moving inexorably further and further offshore and deeper into the ocean. So knowing about these things, knowing about the value of sponges, for heaven's sakes, some of the earliest forms of multicellular life, the sponges, once formed huge reefs in the ocean. Now we see the equivalent in coral reefs. There are a few places, such as up off the coast of Vancouver, and places that have been discovered in Australia and New Zealand, where sponge reefs are dominant in the deep parts of the ocean. They're clues to what was life like half a billion years ago, and who lives within the tissues of the sponges. A lot of small creatures set up housekeeping, like living in a hotel, anything that has structure to it, like the branches of a coral, of coral formations, or the domed structures of coral as well, have barnacles living actually inside the mass of the coral heads or the branches. Other creatures tuck in among the crevices and crannies, like little fish and crabs and shrimp and others. So it's taken millions of years to develop the complexity that we find in coral reefs, whether they're shallow or deep, or sponge reefs, or even in the water itself. They're a living system, perhaps the largest, most diverse ecosystem on the planet, is that continuous mass of ocean water, the open sea, the deep sea, the living volume of water. It's a magical place that we're just beginning to explore and understand. It's the circulatory system for the planet. It's what keeps us alive.
The report, early in the first few pages of the book, there's a 2004 report mentioned, Sylvia, on the status of coral reefs.
Yeah.
20% destroyed in half a century, 60% degraded, and at risk of loss from human actions. In the Caribbean, the decline is great as 80% in many areas. Yeah. In Jamaica, 95% gone.
Our lifetime, on our watch. That's what really annoys me most of all. You know,
right.
We're sitting around and it's happening on our watch. Will our, not just our great-great-great-grandchildren, but our children, even in our lifetime, even in my lifetime, already, how can we stand by and let this happen when we can do something about it? Why are the reefs happening? Why is this going on? Well, because we're taking the fish out of the system. It isn't just the coral that makes a coral reef a coral reef. It, like a city, is not just the buildings. Who lives there? Of course, mm-hmm. A coral reef, the buildings are alive. But in a coral reef or any ocean ecosystem, a kelp forest or even a great sandy plain, it's alive. And to just think of it as something that is there for us to extract without consequences is really not doing justice to our own intelligence. We now know better. And now that we know, we can take actions that will at least stop the damage. And if we give nature a break, there's hope that we can actually reverse these really worrisome trends.
Is there a way to grow coral reefs again?
Yes. There are two things that work. One is stop the destruction, you know, back off, protect areas, marine protected areas, a great idea that is new in the 20th century and one of the best ideas for the 21st century, to do for the ocean what we have demonstrated works on the land, national parks, wildlife reserves, protected areas. If we want to have a few wild birds to eat, like ducks and geese and pheasants and quail and turkeys and things, protect the habitat. Don't take them anywhere at any time in any numbers. Protect the wetlands on the land if you want to have ducks and geese to eat once in a while. In the ocean, it's exactly the same thing for the fish. Have to protect the breeding areas, the feeding areas, the corridors over which they travel, just as we have understood the need to protect migratory routes for birds. If we want to have them because we love them alive or because we want to have them once in a while to take home for dinner. In the ocean, we have not applied these principles. In fact, one of the perverse things that is so worrisome, the reason that there are so few grouper and snapper that once were so abundant when I was a kid, for example, they were in waters wherever mm-hmm. I went in the tropics. Today, they're rare. Mm. And it's because we have taken them where they get together to breed. It's so tempting when you see tens of thousands of fish getting together to hoop it up and do what it takes to make more fish. The fishermen say, wow, what a bonanza. And so they go out and they take them. They take nearly all. And that leaves not too many for reproduction. It's true with the tunas in the Mediterranean and in the Gulf of Mexico and off the coast of wherever it is that they gather together in significant numbers to do what it takes to make more tuna or more of these menhaden, for example, when they're gathering together to make more menhaden. That's when the fishermen have a short-term wild time and get a lot of fish, but the numbers that we have seen it happen in just a few decades, they have dropped off in astonishing numbers. The codfish, where were they 500 years ago? They were everywhere in the North Atlantic. Where are they today? In a few pockets that are hanging on by barely surviving. Brought about the collapse of one of the great ocean resources in our lifetime. The last 50 years have just been catastrophic mm-hmm. for wildlife in the sea.
More phone calls for Sylvia in a moment. Our guest this hour is Sylvia Earle. She is the author of National Geographic's Ocean, an Illustrated Atlas. And our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. She's led more than 60 expeditions as an oceanographer and explorer, has authored all kinds of publications, lectured all over the world, and she is our guest this hour. Thanks very much for your call, Keith. More in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, we go to Paul from New Berlin. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Kathleen. Sylvia, I'm so appreciative of, you know, your life and what you've experienced. And I was wondering what we could do in our lives to help alleviate the problems that you've identified as far as consumers, what we can help our representatives in government promote for, you know, as far as international treaties or Department of the Interior, different policies that need to be turned around. Any specifics that you can give us that we can do?
Absolutely. Well, one of the most important things we can do is support the establishment of protected areas, large ones, not just little token patches here and there, although every square inch counts, as far as I'm concerned, of protecting the places that provide hope for bringing health back to the ocean. So I think identifying and then embracing breeding areas, feeding areas, nursery areas, and areas that are still in pretty good shape. There presently are 14 such places that have a modest amount of protection, national marine sanctuaries, and around the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, the national monument that's really significantly large. It was established just 2 years ago, 2006, 140,000 square miles of ocean. It's one of the best bits of news for the ocean for this country. But we need to do a lot more with international treaties. It basically has worked for a number of years with whales. We stopped killing them commercially in the mid-1980s, and we're seeing a recovery of at least some species. We need to think about similar things for fish. Just give them a big break. For your sake, as well as for the fish, I think that there's some concerns about eating wild fish, especially those high in the food chain. One of my favorite organizations is one called Wild Aid, that headed by Peter Knights, who has campaigned for some years about looking at consumers, the marketplace, for turning some of these things around for wildlife on the land and in the sea. One of the big problems is sharks and shark fin. They're among the creatures that have declined on the order of 90% in the last 50 years because increasingly there's this appetite for shark fin soup. With a new Asian wealth and the luxury taste for shark fin soup, it doesn't really taste all that good as far as I'm concerned, but it's become the she thing to do in the United States, in Europe, as well as in Asia. So what Peter Knight says is when the buying stops, the killing can too. If we stop making these unfortunate choices in restaurants and supermarkets about tuna and swordfish and shark, then there is no incentive to kill them. It's so logical and so simple. It's people pressure. And ask questions when you go to a restaurant. Where did this tuna come from? Most people, really, most restaurants, most supermarkets, can't really tell you where the fish is or if it is what it says it is. There's some really remarkable stories about things called snapper that turn out to be any of 20 different kinds of creatures. So be smart. Ask questions. Know what you're eating. Know what you're buying. And I say to people, if take a child into some place wild, through the eyes of children, you can see the future. Imagine the world they're growing up into. Make choices that are inclined to ensure that the world they do inherit is the kind of world you would like to have for yourself. And if you don't have a child, borrow one. but see what it's like to have that sense of wonder that kids naturally have, that sense of curiosity that somehow we're born with, but along the way a lot of people lose. Recover it. Inform yourself. Be curious. Go look in the ocean. I strongly urge people to go see for themselves what they've been missing. If you're near a lake or a stream, put on a face mask. Go see what the fish are up to. It'll just change the way you look at yourself.
Yeah.
And certainly support policies that are aimed at protecting the natural world.
Sylvia, I'm sorry. I was just wondering, what do you eat?
Well, you know, humans, one of the reasons that we're so successful is that we can eat just about anything and get away with it. Many of the creatures on Earth are specialists. They can only eat a certain kind of leaf, or they can only consume a certain kind of animal. But we can eat almost anything. And I am an omnivore, but I am low on the food chain, and I have stopped eating seafood entirely. Although, I have to say, I've eaten more than my share over the years, but now that I know what I know, I really can't. I know too much. I just can't do it.
Thanks, Paul, very much for the call. Let's go next to Carol. Hi, Carol, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. As I listened to you, I went, oh, my goodness, what an opportunity to reverence life. Anyway, my question, or my, I wonder how you feel about the Supreme Court's decision to allow the military to continue their maneuvers.
Well, I have mixed feelings because, on one hand, I'm keenly aware of security issues that we face at this point in history. Not everybody loves us, of course, but so we have to be concerned about taking measures to protect ourselves so that we can do a better job of protecting the world. But on the other hand, I think that this was a misinformed decision. There is the attitude. I read some of the opinions that were rendered that the security issues outweigh the concerns, and they seem to think that the evidence was thin about the impact on marine mammals. Well, the evidence is not thin. There are impacts of the high intensity sound that we're putting into the sea, both for these military reasons and also perhaps even more important, that the Supreme Court has not been asked to weigh in on the huge amount of sound that has entered the sea, especially during the latter part of the 20th century and now going forward with transportation and with geological surveys, all for good purposes, but oblivious to the impact of what's happening to life in the sea. And it isn't just marine mammals. Many creatures, including the fish, are vulnerable to these great new sources of sound. Going back to the 1950s, Jacques Cousteau wrote a book called The Silent World, because to us it seems, relatively speaking, silent, but it is not a silent place at all. Fish, nearly all fish, make some kind of sound. Crustaceans, shrimp and crabs make sounds. Some of them actually communicate with sound. And naturally, all the marine mammals, the seals, the dolphins, the whales, for them, sound is as important as sight is to us. They actually find food. The toothed whales use their own form of sonar, pinging the ocean to find not only creatures that they consume, but their fellow whales and dolphins and seals and sea lions. It's how they like birds. They communicate that way by creating these huge volumes of sound, especially in lanes of traffic. We have altered the nature of the ocean itself. These are things, now that we know, we can perhaps build quieter machines. We can find other ways to sense where submarines are. Actually, as I understand it, we had a listening array. What is now at question is the active sonar, not a listening, not a passive way of detecting when sounds go by, but like whales and dolphins, to send out big pings of sound that intercept objects that are out there in the ocean. But we go far beyond anything that dolphins and whales and fish and other creatures do in terms of the intensity and volume and the amount of sound that we are putting into the sea. Something new on the planet. Something new in our time. Earth has been around for well, 4.5 billion years, nothing like this ever before. And it's on our watch that these things are happening. We, at first, at least, need to be informed.
And you've helped us become informed. The interview, I'm sure, will carry on for many of us. Thank you, Sylvia, so much for being with us. Great hour. Sylvia Earle, our guest, she is the co-author of National Geographic's new gorgeous book, Ocean and Illustrated History. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Carmen Jackson for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee for all of your calls. Thanks, everybody. We'll be with you again on Monday for All Things Political at our 9 o'clock segment and other interesting conversation at 10. So until then, it's a minute now before 11 o'clock. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.